On this edition of the program, Joe Biden heads to Florida to prove a point. What exactly is that point? We will discuss. And Bill Scheer is on the show to talk about the long and winding road for foreign aid in Congress and what they're going to do beyond that and some parenting tips. It's all coming up.
This is made possible by Blue Front and the Lenina. Owe them bones. Daily Tech News Show. V. And Craig.
Politics, 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 politics. Politics, yes, yes, yes. Trouble, 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 trouble.
That is Margaritaville, sung live earlier this month by an all-star cast, including Paul McCartney, Brandi Carlile, Kenny Chesney, and Pitbull, amongst others, at a concert in Los Angeles entitled Keep the Party Going, a tribute to Jimmy Buffett. Had a friend there, said it was absolutely phenomenal. But of course, it happened for a sad reason. Jimmy Buffett is dead. And if the parrot heads are without the head of their flock, it stands to question whether there's also a changing of the guard in the state that Buffett was most attached to, the Sunshine State of Florida. Despite Democrats being on a two-decade statewide losing streak in Florida, Biden was in the Sunshine State yesterday, pitching the idea that he could win in November. Why? Abortion. And quite simply, because there could be an abortion referendum on the ballot this November. Biden Communications Director Michael Tyler had this to say to reporters, according to Politico, quote, Trump will do everything he can to ban abortion nationwide. Whenever Trump has had power, he's used it to take away rights from women. His track record of disrespecting women is famously consistent, spans decades, includes his personal life, his business career, and his time as an elected official. He continued, the last time there was an abortion referendum on the ballot in 2012, President Barack Obama won the state. So, with our enormous financial advantage, Biden-Harris campaign can afford to invest in many paths to victory, and that includes Florida. Now, to the first part of Tyler's statement, I would say that the Democrats had Barack Obama at the top of the ticket of 2012, and Barack Obama is not walking through that door. But to the second sentence, I think he's told the real tale of why Biden was in the city of the Gasparilla Pirate Festival and Mons Venus. Money. Namely, that Biden has it and Trump doesn't. That's a little bit misleading. Trump has tens of millions of dollars on hand, but lags Biden by nearly $100 million, according to the most recent filings. That means Trump world needs to be careful about budgeting where they spend. And Team Biden can spend money deliberately designed to make Trump spend money that they might not have. My opinion, that's Florida. I don't think anybody in the Biden war room is seriously counting on Florida when it comes to their path to victory, at least not in the same way that they will on Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, as well as Nevada, Arizona, and Georgia. But they are serious about making Trump think they're serious enough to send the president. And since he's there, Biden can use the state as a backdrop for a message that resonates with the voters that they want to turn out. On November, you can make sure that America does not become the hellhole that is Florida. Look at what's happening. They're banning books. They're restricting abortion. They're killing Jimmy Buffett. Now, it'll be an uphill climb for the locals. After the last two decades, there are nearly a million more registered Republicans than Democrats in Florida. But, hell, plays to their voters when they watch on MSNBC, which begins its broadcast day with Morning Joe, a show that is largely broadcast out of the apartment of their married co-hosts, Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski, in Miami, Florida. This is your update brought to you by TakePoliticsSeriously.com. It's where you can support this show, an entirely independent media affair that is only here because of you. Thank you. Thank you to everybody who's signed up at the $3 level. You get two bonus podcasts each and every week, one on Sunday. And it was a great episode on Sunday because we had a big weekend in Congress. Not always big weekends in Congress, but essentially the fever broke in the House. We have some big winners and some big losers. They did their crowing on Sunday, and we did a lot of talking about foreign aid. And you heard from the establishments, not only of the Republicans, the Democrats, but also the media, what they want you to know. That's what those Sunday shows are for. And you get the recaps each and every Monday morning at TakePoliticsSeriously.com, $3 level. You also get the late edition. That's the podcast that comes out Thursday. That's the latest that we cover news. And in this season, when things happen really, really, really fast, well, it's a good tool in your toolbox if you want to stay on top of things. TakePoliticsSeriously.com. Let's go ahead and get to some stories that we didn't get a chance to talk about on the main show. In response to recent highway blockings by protesters of the Israel-Hamas war, California lawmakers are pushing to increase the penalties for such demonstrations. A bill spearheaded by Republican Assemblymember Kate Sanchez received bipartisan support in a key committee vote, signaling a rare division among the predominantly Democratic state legislature. The proposed legislation aims to double the fine for protesters who obstruct highways and hinder emergency vehicles, escalating it from $100 to $200, with potential penalties up to $1,000 for repeated offenses within 3 years. The legislative move comes after protesters chained themselves to vehicles on the Golden Gate Bridge, disrupting traffic and highlighting the intensifying frequency and danger of such actions. Sanchez cited severe consequences from the protests, including delays to critical medical procedures like organ transplants at a local hospital. Despite the bill's progress, it faces opposition from some, including Assemblymember Lori Wilson, chair of the Transportation Committee, who argues that existing penalties are adequate and doubts the bill's efficiency in addressing the root causes of the protests. Well, I don't think that the penalties would be there to address the root causes. You know, that would require other legislation and political decision-making. But if you are just looking to address something that has become a consistent issue, at least in the Bay Area, well, then I would suggest upping some kind of penalties. And I'm not shocked that there's bipartisan support. As a resident, a former resident of the Bay Area, I can tell you that Oakland specifically and San Francisco connectively, riots and protests on a national level. The offense does not need to happen in Oakland for people to smash out windows in Oakland, or, as became increasingly popular during the Black Lives Matter protests, shut down the bridges. What you have to understand about the layout of the Bay Area is that it is largely connected by two major bridges. The Golden Gate Bridge, which is the famous one. You've seen the opening credits of Full House. And the Bay Bridge, which you may have seen if you've watched a Golden State Warriors game. That's the glittering bridge that they come in on B-roll as they are about to start the game. The Golden Gate Bridge is a lot easier to shut down because it's not very big. The Bay Bridge, which recently had a gigantic new span in, over the last 7 years is a lot more challenging. And yet it has been done. The fact that it is something that can be done means that it will be done in the future. Say what you will about the Bay Area, but they will not stop protesting. It is part of the DNA of that region. And so the question becomes, how high do you want to make the price for people who want to prove their point? Civil disobedience is still disobedience at the end of the day, and there is some kind of penalty that you need to pay so you can demonstrate how serious these causes are. I don't think raising the fine from $100 to $200 is something that is too costly of a hike, but we'll see whether or not it can pass California's very Democratic state legislature. We move from one protest to another. Escalating tensions over the Israel-Hamas conflict have roiled prestigious U.S. universities like Columbia, NYU, Yale, and Harvard, who have each taken measures to manage campus safety and expression. Columbia canceled in-person classes and Harvard restricted access to the Harvard Yard, emphasizing campus security due to ongoing protests. NYU witnessed arrests after reports of disorderly conduct and anti-Semitic incidents among protesters. Over 100 demonstrators were arrested at Columbia, with similar situations unfolding at Yale, where 45 protesters faced misdemeanor trespassing charges. The university response is to highlight the challenge of balancing free expression and safety, as well as inclusivity on campuses. At Columbia, the administration offered virtual classes to ensure safety, while tensions rose with protests demanding the condemnation of Israel's action and divestment from companies supporting military activities. Harvard and Yale also took steps to control campus demonstrations, reflecting widespread administrative concerns about maintaining order and upholding policies during these highly charged times. These measures have sparked debates about the limits of protest and free speech, particularly in the context of an academic setting. I believe that this entire situation is the consequence of the parasitic nature of colleges and the student loans that make them run. College kids acting up and protesting is nothing new. It has thankfully not been deadly in this country since Kent State, or at least from authority figures, but college kids getting dragged out of administrative buildings is something that happens. You know, you're about that age. Your brain's not fully formed. You've just learned a lot of really, really, really important ideas. And boy, do you want to get them out there. And this is not me criticizing anything about the current set of issues. Everybody is very, very, very welcome to have a wide range of them. But here's the problem. And it is, to me, chickens coming home to roost on something that has been an issue for a while on college campuses. Coddling of students, not because they necessarily fit into the ideological spectrum of many of the professors, but rather because the colleges need them to keep this absolute bonanza of cash flowing. There's a reason why college tuitions have continued to rise, and that's because banks continue to guarantee student loans at a higher and higher rate, despite the fact that the worth of those degrees seems to be actively deteriorating. So, if the students are paying more and more, then I think, befits them to understand that they need to respect the authority of those institutions more and more in kind. This is essentially a high-priced resort instead of a spa and a swim-up bar. You have beer pong and some kind of education, I guess, along the way. You can make the most of it, like a gym, which many of these places also have. But why would you listen to them when they tell you that you can't be on campus past a certain time, or you can't pitch a tent, or you can't smear red paint on somebody, some professor's door? You can't chant, "We love Hamas and their rockets too." Why would you respect them? Why would you respect the university when they don't respect you? Now, I don't think that this is something that students are saying, but the power dynamic has long changed. If some of these schools wanted to be really, really tough and disciplinarian, they could just expel a lot of these kids, but then they wouldn't get the money now, would they? In a weird way, I'm glad these are happening, because it is a final stage of what I think has been a toxic relationship that not only has enriched universities that have continued to stray further and further away from their initial mission of making sure that these young kids have a better life going forward for their affiliation with your institution, and the parasitic banks that have emboldened this. There we go. That was more of a monologue than it was analysis, but that's my two cents. TikTok faces a potential ban or change in ownership in the United States as Congress pushes legislation that would require ByteDance, TikTok's Chinese parent company, to divest its stake within a year or cease operations. This is one of the big stories we talked about during the Monday episode of this show. The bill, which passed the House this weekend, is expected to pass the Senate as early as Tuesday, so it might have already happened by the time you're listening. And the reason why is because it's attached to a larger foreign aid package for Ukraine, Israel, and other allies, indicating strong bipartisan support. TikTok has actively mobilized its user base to protest against the bill, urging them to contact lawmakers, a move that was seen as backfiring. Another move that was seen as backfiring was the Chinese embassy apparently trying to lobby on behalf of TikTok, which only apparently succeeded in the staffers for various different congresspeople immediately running to the press and saying, "Wait a minute, why is the Chinese embassy lobbying on behalf of a company that has gone out of its way to say that it's not Chinese?" The bill, which President Biden is expected to sign, sets a tight timeline for ByteDance to sell TikTok, with an initial 9-month deadline that could extend for an additional 3 months after that. Really, the only change in the bill that passed the House and the one that is going to pass the Senate this week is an extra few months. One that puts a divestiture and ban after the election. Potential buyers include tech giants like Microsoft and Oracle, as well as private equity groups. Through the sale of TikTok without its core algorithms would complicate the process. This outcome could significantly affect social media, potentially benefiting competitors like Meta and Google if TikTok were to migrate to other platforms, that is, the TikTok community. We're going to have Tom Merritt on the show on Friday to talk about this in greater detail, so I'll save a lot of my opinions for that. But I will just say this. It is fascinating how this matriculated through Congress. Not only to be a rare bipartisan, nearly unanimous support across parties in the House initially, but then to stall in the Senate, have almost no changes, only to be put in another package that is a must pass and have it run through the Senate. There's a lot. There's a lot there. And that is your update. TakePoliticsSeriously.com. It's where you need to go to sign up for the Titanic $10 tier, which gets your name right at the end of the show, the $3 Club, which gets you those two bonus podcasts, and much more. TakePoliticsSeriously.com. Thank you for your support. It has been a long and winding road for a foreign policy package that will likely pass the Senate and be signed by Joe Biden this week to talk about that and so much more. We have Washington Monthly's Bill Scheer, our old friend, back on the program. How you doing, Bill?
Great to be with you, and congratulations on your familial news.
Yes, yes. No, thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. You were among the first to hit me up, and I greatly appreciate it.
No, I'm a grizzled parental veteran. I got
you are.
I got a teen and a tween, so I've been through it. I'm not even fully through it, but I've been through a lot.
But you've been through the early years. It seems like things move in sort of different phases. You are into a different level of the DLC.
I can't even like demarcate it into stages. It's just a constant moving target. I have no romanticization of this process. So you should get, you need a stiff dose of reality as you enter into this phase of your life.
Yeah. Well, that's the biggest thing that I am looking at it from a perspective of is just head on a swivel. Like you're never comfortable, just always correct. On the move.
Here, if there's one thing I could say to any, new parent,
okay,
one bit of wisdom I can impart is to never yell at your children.
Okay.
And I'm a pragmatist.
Yeah, you are. Yeah.
This is not just like a moral belief. I'm telling you this because one, we all have our limits.
Yeah.
We all have our breaking points. Like some of us may be more zen than others, but everyone's got their limit.
Yeah.
And your child will find your limit.
Yes.
They are just bottomless pits of irrationality, and they will find something to do that will break you. And if you don't have a game plan, when do you get mad in life? You get mad and you raise your voice when like nothing else seems to work.
Sure.
And there'll be just infinite times where you're going to feel that way, with kids, because things just get thrown at you. Things you never thought would come out of their mouths or they would do like happen and you're not prepared for it. You got to make snap judgments what to do in that moment. And it's like you would never hit your kid. You just never do it. Like your brain is like wired that, maybe 50 years ago you'd spank, but no one's doing that these days,
So yeah.
You just know like you wouldn't cross that line. Yelling, you don't have that line firmly fixed in your brain the way you do about physical violence. But
yeah.
You have to get there, because if you don't, they model your behavior. They will throw it back at you. They will remember things you did to them 5 years ago. Well, you yelled at me when I urinated on your birthday cake. So
exactly. Yeah. And what you don't want is for that lesson to be revisited to you while you're trying to get them quiet on a plane ride from here to Los Angeles. Yeah.
Well, and a child is going to be dysregulated at various points of their life because they are children.
Yes.
Your job is to show them you don't have to be that way. You have to model behavior you want them to emulate. I know this sucks. I know you're stressed about this. I know you're disappointed. Here's how I deal with it. I'm not telling you. I'm showing you with how
I'm showing you what it is. Yeah, that's I was raised with a single mother by and large, and she was not a yeller. The most devastating things were moments of quiet, and the most heartbreaking things were times where I knew that I had made her sad. And so I assume if we are working with the same hardware, my child will have the same hardware, that these are the things that tend to motivate far more than gigantic expressive outbursts. But then again, I also know that a lot of this is a lot easier to say than to do when you are in the trenches.
You need to have so much mental preparation in advance.
Yeah.
What am I going to do when the time comes, when they do something that just totally makes me insane? It's not a snap judgment. If you're leaving it to snap judgment, you're going to yell or do things you'll regret. You got to think about it well in advance. How am I going to build up the intestinal fortitude to not let it fly when I'm in the moment? That's what's hard.
This has been the best, the best reassurance that spending a lot of time on Twitter is good for something.
Yes.
to model my own level of regulation when I see something that just makes me literally insane and wants me to throw everything out the window, my job, my sanity, and just type to a bunch of random people on the internet. This has at least given me a level of patience that I can apply to my child.
I'm here to serve.
Well, let's talk about another long and arduous process. Unlike raising a child, this certainly took a long time, over 6 months from the last time that there was a Ukraine funding bill that passed. It had been in the works for really, you know, almost immediately after the last one passed, and yet it took a long time. What happened between then and now that made things so complicated and caused the White House, a contingent of the Republicans and a contingent of the Democrats, to try to put three or four different shades of lighting and sweeteners on this before it eventually went through this weekend?
I mean, I can't get fully inside Mike Johnson's head. So I don't know, like, when exactly did the switch flip? They decide, okay, I really need to, you know, put my chips on the table and make this happen. But I do think, one, we learned that at bottom, Mike Johnson is a Reagan Republican more than a Trump Republican, at least when it comes to foreign policy. He did not want his legacy to be the guy that let Putin took over Ukraine and perhaps go beyond that. He heard the intelligence briefings from the Biden administration and accepted them and acted on them, which is credit to both, you know, Joe Biden's team and to Johnson himself. Now, I suspect, and you might recall, I was not a fan of the shivving of Kevin McCarthy. I was not a fan of Democrats helping to shiv Kevin McCarthy. I did not think he had already kept the government open against the will of the Matt Gaetz crew. That to me was a positive sign. I'm not saying Kevin McCarthy is, you know, a giant hero, but he was doing as much as you could expect a Republican speaker to do.
But then he made the unforgivable sin of talking wild on Face the Nation. And for that, he needed to go.
He said mean things to Democrats. Democrats took it personally. They felt they couldn't trust him. And so they threw him overboard. And so then you're left with Mike Johnson, who got to power with the help of the Matt Gaetz crew. And so he has been, to some, in a certain sense, more beholden to them. Now, of course, he's disappointed them at various points, but I think there's been more kabuki involved because he's trying to keep that at bay and trying to avoid the motion to vacate if all possible. So I can't prove it definitively, but I suspect this got more dragged out because Johnson got there with the Gaetz people, whereas McCarthy had already said to them, you know what, this tail's not going to wag my dog. And he could have been kept with Democratic help, which would have further illuminated that fact. But that's in the past. You did have, in between Johnson getting the gavel and this vote, this whole border bill drama, where the Senate negotiators, Sinema, Chris Murphy, James Lankford, agreed on a border bill compromise, which Johnson had been insisting on. He said, we can't do Ukraine without taking care of the border. And then when a bill was actually presented to him, Johnson flinched and said, this is dead on arrival. Would McCarthy have done that? McCarthy and Sinema were workout buddies. So again, I can't know for a fact that he would. I think there are higher odds of it, but having said that, I think we have also learned that as much bipartisanship has happened in the past, you know, 2+ years, and it's not an insignificant amount.
Yeah.
Immigration in the Trump era of the Republican Party is the thing that really animates him and much of his followers. So to do a deal there is asking a lot, because it really undermines a lot of the basis of what Trump wants to run on and how he wants the party to be defined. So in one potential analysis here, you could say Johnson had to get past that. He I mean, either he was willing to sort of take it on and divide the party on that score, which is a lot to ask. Since he obviously wasn't willing to do that, he had to find a way to make the border irrelevant to the discussion, no longer make it a condition to passing Ukraine funding. So we had a deal, we rejected the deal, we let some space pass between that deal and this vote, where in that period, Ukraine is losing more ground and in more dire circumstances. And the intelligence briefings say so, where Johnson could say, you know what, this is so important that we cannot let Ukraine lose, that whatever I said about the border before is inoperative. I didn't say that bluntly, but I think the read between the lines is what he was saying. This has to be taken care of now because it's for our security and global security. I think it's how we got there.
You mentioned at least one of the big different versions of this that came down the pike. The first that I can remember was, let's remember this is actually a jobs bill. Talking about how much this is mostly us giving old weapons. The money that's being spent is for us to replenish our own weapons. Then October 7th happens. For a very brief moment, there is more consensus bipartisan on Israel. Obviously, that has become something that is more complicated on the left as we go forward. But the idea being, okay, let's put these things together. We are now doing a larger foreign aid package. Then we have the border. Hey, if you want this to be something that takes care of the southern border, we'll have this Senate negotiation. The House says no. We passed HR 2. Trump says no. That gets that's dead in the water. And now we eventually get to this. Matt Gaetz sat mostly on the sideline in terms of the motion to vacate, but Mike Johnson's new tormentor was Marjorie Taylor Greene, who had a far closer relationship with Kevin McCarthy.
Right,
but it seems
very weird.
I mean, all of this is just very odd. The miasma of alliances here, especially considering some of the folks that ousted Kevin McCarthy have left, leaving the Republican majority at one. I mean, now there's going to be special elections that'll bump it up a little bit. But at the end of the day, who else wants to do this job but Mike Johnson? This is the worst job in Washington. Nobody in the Republican conference who wanted to do it could do it because they had more than five enemies. Mike Johnson at that point was the only guy in the room that had less than five enemies. So congratulations, you get Hudsucker proxied to the speakership. And now he had to move things forward. What I don't get is on the Republican side, you don't control the Senate. You don't control the White House. I understand that it is certainly profitable to go on Twitter and to go on cable news and scream and yell that the country is going in the wrong direction. I just don't understand why you are attacking Mike Johnson and not the other party for which an election is coming up that could benefit your cause. Attacking Mike Johnson just seems asinine to me when it is an impossible job to do.
Well, I think this is, you know, what Trump's party is. I mean, Trump got there in the first place by attacking fellow Republicans.
Yeah.
There is an element of the Republican base that is become very antagonistic towards Republican establishment, and you gain credibility by attacking them. And people in like Taylor Greene, who are in very deep red districts, you know, there is no political risk for her locally to do that. And in this issue in particular, I think you have a very, very deep divide in the Republican Party when it comes to Russia and Ukraine. The whole America First rubric that Trump has put forth there, which is in many ways really a Russia First mentality. The party is not anywhere close to a consensus on that point. And Johnson, who was sort of casually casting anti-Ukraine aid votes when he was a backbencher, we learn when he gets into a leadership position, that's not really where his head and heart are at. And that vote on the Republican side, if I remember correctly, you had a few more Republican no votes for Ukraine aid than yes votes. Although some of them were probably vote no hope yes people. And you know, and contrast that with the Democratic vote on Israel funding, where you had a very small faction of Democrats voting against that, even though there's a divide there. I'm not saying there isn't a divide.
Yeah.
But I don't think that divide runs as deeply, because even people who might be more sympathetic to the Palestinian view or more sympathetic to the Israeli view, almost all of them in the Democratic Party want a two-state solution. They want to get to the same place. The number of people who are from river to the sea people, I think, is very, very small. On the Republican side, the people who are saying, we have to stop Putin, we can't let Putin take over Europe, and the people are saying, Putin's our buddy, like, there's no middle ground there. There's no joint destination that they're trying to get to. They just disagree. And Taylor Greene is firmly on the Russia side of this equation, as is Trump, and Mike Johnson is not. So that is why I think Taylor Greene is very willing to attack Johnson here, because it's not about, one, it doesn't affect her election. She's going to win an election no matter what. And they just believe in fundamentally different things.
So let me push back a little bit, because Trump did do a little cover for Mike Johnson, brought him down to Mar-a-Lago, put on Truth Social that he's MAGA Mike. He had some of his people in his orbit issue Marjorie Taylor Greene needs to settle down, quotes. So I don't from my vantage point see that Trump and Marjorie Taylor Greene are exactly on the same page with this.
Although I do believe Trump made a comment afterwards that was a little less effusive towards Johnson, that sort of raised the possibility he was an inch away.
Look, much like you mentioned in terms of parenting, there's a constantly moving right. target. Oftentimes that is where Donald Trump's
is just so mercurial when it comes to these
non-negotiables.
You know, he can often contradict himself. And you can make the argument that he doesn't believe anything. I think he believes in some things, but how they get conveyed, how consistently it get conveyed, can also be a moving target. He may have people whispering in his ear who are like, look, you don't want to be in a giant fight with the speaker going to this election. You know, you don't need to take on everybody. Yeah. Can you just do this and like not make this become a total cluster, you know, going forward?
Fiasco. Yeah.
But I think Trump has said enough stuff about Russia and Ukraine to know that he means what he says when he is prepared to like give away large chunks of Ukraine to Putin as soon as he gets into office. And he has said flat out before they didn't want to spend any more money on Ukraine. So I think it's what he believes.
It does seem, though, that polling has shown there is less enthusiasm for the defense of Ukraine than there was 2 years ago when this war started. And there is a creeping element that maybe there is just a reality that there is going to have to be an end of hostilities and the United States might have to play some role in negotiating it. How much of that do you think factored into this?
I don't think it factored into it at all.
I
haven't done a check on like the most recent polling on the question, but you can find those numbers can slosh around depending on how you word exactly. I think it's very notable that Democrats were saying, we shiv McCarthy. We'll save you, Johnson, as long as you do Ukraine funding. Like, that is not something that, I mean, I think Democrats, by and large, are for Ukraine funding. Well, if you ask the average Democrat, like, what's your top three positions? You know, abortion and democracy are going to go much higher than Ukraine. But they were willing to essentially cross the aisle and save a speaker just on Ukraine. Do this one thing. Everything. You impeach Mayorkas. I don't care. If you save Ukraine, I'll keep you a speaker. Like, that to me speaks to belief that this is just something that has to happen if we're going to live in a safe and secure world. And it's not about electoral politics.
I'm of the belief that the Iraq war fundamentally changed the polarity of politics when it comes to foreign entanglements. And obviously we are not talking about a situation where the United States is sending anybody over to fight either in Israel or in Ukraine. But foreign aid seems like more of a fraught conversation just generally than it would have been 20 years ago. I wonder whether or not we are going to continue to see attrition or complication, or whether or not, and this is something that I would put on the White House, that the narrative of where we are and where we're going with Ukraine, aside from this is a battle for the soul of Earth and we need to continue to put money into it for as long as we need to, is something that America does need to hear and understand more.
Well, I think the political scar tissue from the Iraq war is leading us more towards aid as opposed to troops. You know, you have almost no conversation in any foreign crisis from either party about time to drop bombs, time to send troops. You know, that kind of thing was much more prevalent in terms of debate in the 1990s with Bosnia, and as well as with Iraq in the Bush years. That is almost like not like a
save for Lindsey Graham. Lindsey Graham might be the only one who still goes on television and says we need to invade Tehran tomorrow.
Right. Which, you know, but the guy that he's endorsing, Donald Trump, would not say that. And Donald Trump has even sounded like, you know, hey Israel, maybe you should, you know, dial it back a few notches too. Which didn't get a lot of
attention, but he wrote in one of the pro Netanyahu papers a column saying, I think it was like, finish the job, but do it quickly.
So look, there's just not a lot of appetite for putting American troops on the ground and dropping the bombs ourselves. And that is directly an aftermath of how poorly Iraq went. But you are seeing a shifting of tectonic plates in the two parties, where the Democrats, and I don't think this is actually unusual for Democrats, if you could look at the long arc going back to Woodrow Wilson, of saying, we are an internationalist party. What happens on the global stage affects us directly. We can't hide ourselves from it. And we do need to be involved diplomatically, financially, to ensure that we maintain, you know, a secure world order. And look, and there have always been more isolationist elements in the Democratic Party that just don't want to see us spending any money whatsoever, but they've generally not been the dominant force. The Republican Party has often has interventionists and isolationists in their party, going back to like the Taft years, you know, in the early 20th century. But now Donald Trump has taken that isolationist wing and made it dominant, more dominant, at the very least in rough parity with the more interventionist side. And that is really roiling, like, and questioning what is the Republican Party? What do they stand for here? Like, that's a much more open question than I think where the Democratic Party stands on these matters.
Yeah, I would agree. I think obviously there is, you know, there was a civil war that erupted in 2016. As soon as you take out a power structure that was as just old growth as the Republican power structure was, Donald Trump pretty much cuts the head off it in 2016 in one clean strike. And we're still trying to figure out, including Trump, exactly where is that line between revolutionary and leader.
Well, even in 2016,
he's never really.
In his presidency, the vestiges of the old Republican national security establishment were still present in his administration and often constraining.
Oh,
him.
Yeah.
And, most notably, whether he was going to stay in NATO or not. And what is a more uncertain question is to how much is that balance going to be thrown off in a second Trump presidency, where he feels like these people ruined my first presidential term and I don't need to listen to any of them anymore. And I can just go off completely half-cocked. That's obviously the fear that he wouldn't have the same guardrails the second time around as he did the first time.
Well, but I mean, I totally agree with you. He has brought a level of isolationism, or at least skepticism at the very least, into the mainstream on a level that we haven't seen it in my lifetime. And at the same time, he hired John Bolton. So like there was, again, a moving target how interventionalist he wanted to be.
I mean, Trump clearly hired people without much thought in terms of what their bottom line policies were going to be. He was making decisions based on like who looks good on TV half the time. And now there is this whole, you know, Heritage Foundation, Project 2025 operation, which is not literally tied to Trump, but is effectively tied to Trump, trying to build essentially an alternative Republican Party establishment that believes in very different things. And it is designed to, just like with the Supreme Court, the Federalist Society, we're going to pre-vet the candidates. We're going to tell you who is going to be with us on overturning Roe. You don't have to do that legwork. We did that legwork for you. Here's the list. You draw off that list. Heritage is now doing that for like the rest of government. I can't tell you I'm not clairvoyant if Trump's going to just pluck their names or not, but that obviously is the intent. And I have little reason to doubt that Trump would be very receptive to that, because he certainly didn't like the way he was constrained by a lot of the old guard folks.
Where do we go from here congressionally? Do you think anything gets done between now and November?
I mean, I'm not really. I mean, you know, they have to keep the government open one more time. The fiscal year ends in September.
So that'll be fun. Right.
And I think we have learned, you know, whether it's McCarthy or Johnson, not a lot of appetite for government shutdown. So they don't believe that really helps them going into an election. But I'm sure there'll be a certain amount of drama that goes into that. But I'm not really aware, and forgive me for being ignorant here, like I can't think of like what's in the queue that's really must pass.
Yeah, that's the thing. I kind of feel like there hasn't really been a big push from the Senate on any gigantic legislation. There hasn't been a gigantic push from the White House legislatively. Yeah. It does seem like this was pretty much the last big hurrah until, like you mentioned, there'll be a certain budget dance going into
September. But I would not expect it. I mean, if maybe they could do a little bit of a extension, you know, short-term resolution, whatever, to get through it. But we may be, Biden may end up being the first president to have no government shutdowns at all since George W. Yep. Bush. And I think before Bush, it might have been Carter or Ford before that. Because I think Reagan and George H.W. Bush had like tiny ones, you know, nothing major.
I'd have
to go back and check. But you know, there's a real argument here, in my opinion. You know, and I've said this before, and it's sometimes it's harder for me to make the case than at other times, but Biden ran on restoring bipartisanship to Washington, D.C., and he succeeded. Yeah.
I mean, it certainly didn't feel like it at times, right. But I mean,
there's obviously a lot of drama
you can't argue with right. that.
Not everyone wants to admit it. Not everyone wants to brag about it. Certain things didn't happen, like the border bill. But I mean, we are literally running the House with a coalition government. Like they are passing
essentially
every bill that passes is like suspension of the rules, 2/3 vote, small faction Republicans dissenting, and then the bills and everything passing the Senate has to be bipartisan, save for your reconciliation bills, and they've already shot those bullets. This is the system working. The budgets are passing. We're not having a debt limit breach. We're funding Ukraine. The bipartisanship is ending at the water's edge. We did infrastructure. We did gun safety. We did semiconductors. We did infrastructure. We didn't say it already. This is pretty good as far as bipartisanship goes.
You wonder what's funny, and nobody wants to take credit except for like Senate candidates in red states.
Yes.
That's pretty much it. Like Sherrod Brown is like, look at everything we did together. But other than that, nobody wants to take credit for it. One last thing, because this was probably the most fascinating congressional story, and it's still ongoing now, and that is the TikTok bill in a house that has been particularly fractious. The TikTok divestment bill explodes out of it. Mm-hmm. It sits in the Senate, which is very odd for me because President Biden said he wanted to sign the bill that came out of the House. Chuck Schumer has never seen a China issue for which he doesn't want to run headlong into and take full credit for. And yet it just sits there.
Isn't it tied to the bill?
Now,
isn't it fully tied to the
bill? Well, now, no. So then another version of it in the House again, that now extends the window for divestment, gets tied to this bill that just came out of the House over the weekend, and that one, the main dissenter in the Senate, Cantwell, says she has no problem with this. Nothing's really changed except for the fact that it extends the period to beyond the election. But I don't know. It's hard for me to wrap my head around why that first bill didn't pass, except to say that the Senate didn't really want their hands on voting for that specifically. And they would rather have it be part of a gigantic package like this, where it's kind of must pass.
I apologize. I can't speak super knowledgeably about it. The fact that Cantwell flipped on it makes me think that the company finds that this is going to be somewhat tolerable in some way. Maybe they're okay with some kind of sale. Maybe they can like sell to an entity that they can like be part of too. It's not as technically as part of, because the guy who runs it is from Singapore, not China. So
the CEO of American TikTok. Right. No, the CEO of ByteDance is Chinese and lives in China. It is TikTok.
Maybe there's a way like that guy can like still run TikTok and just not be part of ByteDance, and if they had extra time, they'll figure it out. I don't know. I'm literally like not the person you want to ask this question to. But
I know, and I was just more on the congressional side of it, because it was very odd to me that Chuck Schumer, of all people, wouldn't want to pass this bill. Chuck Schumer, the senator, I think would have been in front of a camera the second after it came out of the House as its biggest cheerleader.
I don't think Congress is going to do anything that's going to take TikTok out of American people's hands.
I mean, that's what they're doing now. I mean, this will pass the Senate. It will be signed by Joe Biden.
If there is something about this which is going to prevent that from occurring, and that's why they're being very sanguine about it. But I don't know enough to know what that is. But I would be very shocked if they literally said, our votes are going to be on something that's going to literally take away your TikTok. I don't believe they have the gumption to do it.
I mean, at this point, based on the momentum of everything, that would essentially be relying on the idea that they don't feel that the bill is constitutional and it will get an injunction
and will be
overturned.
Maybe they think that's not constitutional. They think that the sale can happen, or they can tweak it down the line or something. I just don't believe they're going to take away people's TikTok, because I think would be.
Well, they certainly will not do it before the election. Yeah. That is now. Canon. It will get extended beyond that, but I don't know. I mean, who knows where we go from here? It is a particularly fascinating story from my perspective, not only from the political side of it, because again, it's like the only thing that anybody could agree on in the House over like a year's period, but also from a tech position, because normally if the government is getting very aggressive with a company in a certain genre, the other companies from that genre, fearing that they could be next, team up to put a united front out there from an industry perspective, except everybody else in this world, Meta, Alphabet, and anybody else, Snapchat, they're all just saying, man, these commies, huh? We should really get them the hell out of here.
Right, right. And look, it's an election year, and you can go back to every single presidential election, and the attacks on China always ramp up during an election season, and they always subside once the election is over. And this is true for, I mean, even Trump, who is premier China basher, but then as president, you know, President Xi, he's great. You know, we're just doing business.
And I make a big deal. I've talked to Xi, good man.
That's not a bad impression.
Thank you. I greatly appreciate that. That'll be the first words that I say to my daughter. You're a beautiful girl. Thank you very much. Bill Scheer, Washington Monthly. Where can people find your work and what are you working on?
Washington Monthly, WashingtonMonthly.com. I write a weekly column and a thrice weekly newsletter for the Washington Monthly. I'm on X at Bill Scheer. I'm on Threads at Bill Scheer Media. And also on the podcast, the DMZ, with my conservative friend, Matt Lewis.
Phenomenal. Everybody go check it out. Always a pleasure to have Bill on the show. Thank you very much for coming on, buddy.
Thank you, sir.
Politics.
And that'll wrap it up for us today. Politics, 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 written and hosted by me, Justin Robert Young, for Dog and Pony Show Audio in Austin, Texas. You want to email the show, one place to do it, theyoungamerican@gmail.com. Thank you to everybody who has sent amazing well wishes for the news that I will be a father at the end of this summer. There will be a little baby jury to witness the election this fall. Hachi Machi. Many of you have been extraordinarily generous with our baby registry. We have a gigantic pile of stuff downstairs that I really, really appreciate you guys buying for us. If you would like to do that, babyjurymore.com is where you can not only find the registry, but also my wife and I have been recording a podcast secretly for the last 7 months since we first began trying, before, when we decided we wanted to try to have a baby. If you are interested in listening to that, you can do so. Link is right there, babyjurymore.com, or you can just search for Jury More on the podcast platform of your choice. If you would like to find clips of this show, it is Justin R. Young on TikTok, Justin R. Young on Instagram. YouTube is Politics, Politics, Politics. By the way, full episodes now. Video and audio, YouTube and audio. Twitter is Justin R. Young, and you can find this podcast and share it with your friends, family, and clergy, px3podcast.com. If you'd like to support us with a one-time donation, it is paypal.me/payjury. Venmo is Justin-Young-20. Cash App is px3cash, and you can send me anything you'd like in the mail. P.O. Box 153184, Austin, Texas 78715. The only way that you can get our bonus content is to go to TakePoliticsSeriously.com. $3 tier gets you 2 bonus podcasts per week covering all the news that we miss on our free podcasting schedule and our Titanic. $10 tier gets your name read at the end of the show like these fine folks in the Titanic. $10 tier. Sugar Brady, who's new. Thanks, Brady. Sam, John, Niemeister, Edwin, invoke Gloria Young for King of the New World Order. Brian, Edison, Jeremy, a dog named Chucker. Sarah Jeannie, Matthew, Dr. G, Dustin, Brad, D. Laser, Nick, just another pilot, middle-aged Mike, Utah, Jimmy, Montana, the Jen, Adam, Alo, D. Reilly, Andrew, Lisa, Fat Tony's PJs from New York, Devon, the CFP, Gloria, Gray Zone, Peepaw, J. Neil, John, DP4 Bongo, Neil, his nerdiness, Charles, Audrey stole Adler's spot, Darren, Idris Arslanian, Berkeley, Steven, Nomadic Terran, Molly's delightful demeanor, Adam, Chief Andy, Robert, Casey, Paul. And that's it. If you would like to be amongst those ranks, have your name read at the end of the show while we are going through the big 2024 cycle. Guys, only one place to do it. TakePoliticsSeriously.com. On Friday's edition of the show, like we mentioned before, we will have the great, the inimitable Tom Merritt on the show. But that's then. See you Thursday if you're a patron. Till next time, this is your old pal Justin Robert Young saying, some shows talk about politics, others talk about politics, and still more discuss politics. But this is the only show that dares discuss all three.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.